The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a two-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
Football Weekly Extra.
Football Weekly Extra, with the best of the action worldwide, from Wembley to Dick's Sporting Goods Park. Today, friendlies, French toast, Wembley win, but not the only side with blank mind running things. We get the grisly details on England's souffle-like collapse from men who were there. And we get Sid on the line to tell us how the world champion Spain lost 4-0 to Portugal. That plus the rest of the midweek friendly news. Elsewhere, there's off-field action, FIFA-ish anticipation of the World Cup bids, and we give two hoots about the Owls' current predicament. Plus, there's the countdown to the big weekend games, FC Dallas and Colorado Rapids in the MLS Cup. And in the Premier League, the North London Derby, Arsenal like Cowboys with Spurs on their heels, plus Bolton Newcastle with Barry's new chum, and West Ham Liverpool. All that plus post and more in Football Weekly Extra. Welcome on board, everybody. I've got a smiling Owen Gibson here.
I don't know why I'm smiling. I'm smiling through the pain.
Smiling through the pain. Kevin McCarr as well, who just revealed that he banged his thumb, listeners, with a hammer. Hi, Kevin.
Okay, walk me up, yep.
Yep, excellent. And also, friend of the stars, Barry Glendinning.
Hello, James.
Hi there, Barry. Later, yeah? Yeah, okay, good. Let's start with a big clash at Wembley. This billed as two of the biggest disappointments of the World Cup coming head-to-head, but I couldn't see Alan Shearer or Adebayor anywhere on my TV coverage. Must have been a different highlight show. You were there, Owen Gibson, and so were you, Kevin.
Indeed.
Yeah.
France were good, weren't they?
I think. Well, yes, they were.
Yeah, do you know, you always think England were rubbish. It was the fault of they should have picked so-and-so, etc. The manager should have done this. I can't think of anything Capello could have done. He picked the team that we thought he should, the men available, give a chance to youth, you know, Jordan Henderson. And basically, I suppose, more experienced players like Gareth Barry were of no help whatsoever to players like Jordan Henderson, who, instead of enjoying being in the ball and playing passes and showing his skill, found himself overrun by France. And I think that's an education, but it's a painful one. And one of the things that impressed me most, by the way, is the fans at Wembley. I think the numbers they turn up in and the loyalty that they show, apart from some token booing at half-time and full-time, is incredible. I know it's cut price tickets for friendlies, but tell me another nation in the world that would have got that size of crowd for a meaningless game.
Especially against a side that have been equally disappointing in the World Cup. L'Equipe described the atmosphere at Wembley as being like Miss Marple's tea room at tea time.
It wasn't particularly boisterous, was it? You know, but I do think, you know, the FA marketing department do deserve some credit for filling it. But yeah, you could definitely hear the French more than the English for obvious reasons. Just felt vaguely depressing for me because, I mean, afterwards, once again, it was all about, well, surely this is about deeper underlying problems. Why can't we pass the ball? Why is the, you know, once again, you had an England manager standing looking morose on the touchline as France stroke Spain stroke Germany stroke whenever we come up against a good team pass the ball around them. And you just think, where you know, we promised this big review after the World Cup answering all the same questions, and there's been no sign of any answers from that.
No answers yet. But the French, they've managed to turn things around nicely, haven't they? And well, you can see why Dominic didn't bother taking Nasri and Benzema to the World Cup.
I mean, well, they reached the absolute nadir, didn't they? Maybe that's a healthy process in a way. I mean, a lot of the vanity and problems in the squad had to be addressed. And
it was a proper clear out, which we obviously.
I mean, obviously players have survived from that time, but there's a new mentality. And I think Laurent Blanc, of course, a younger man, has brought some dynamism to the post. But I mean, the trouble with England is we're going to start talking about academies and so on again. We've been through all this before. I mean, how often do we have to talk about, oh, we can't bring young players through?
But there are a lot. Ternando Forres, the engagingly named poster, says, when was the last season you can remember such a good crop of young English players coming through? Carroll, Albright and Henderson, Martin Kelly, Holden, Wilshere, etc. Other people, though, commenting on the way that Andy Carroll was used.
I disagree,
Barry. Yeah?
That they're comparatively good players. Ah. But they still have no technique. And France can have all the internal strife and turmoil they like. But once the bad eggs are rooted out of the dressing room and new ones are brought in, at least they can pass a football from A to B. That's the problem with England players. It's always been the problem with England players. Their technique stinks. They can't pass a ball. Mm-hmm. When they're under pressure or in trouble, they resort to lumping it up to the big man, which they did last night. They never try and build patiently from the back. I mean, there's no point in reading too much into last night's match. I think the main reason it was staged was to give Adrian Childs the opportunity to remind himself what it's like to broadcast it or present a TV show that lots of people are watching. Everyone seems determined to point...
He's not a Twitter pal of yours, then?
No.
Right.
Everyone seems determined to find somebody to blame, but there's lots of blame to be served up.
There's enough for everyone.
Yeah, Capello for playing Jordan Henderson as a defensive midfielder. He's not a defensive midfielder. Maybe Capello thinks at some point he will be, but I think playing him in that position on his debut is very unfair.
Do you not think he was thinking like a kind of Gattuso Pirlo thing whereby Barry does the defending and
Henderson passes Barry didn't the ball? Do the defending.
But that would be the concept, wouldn't it? Yeah. Not for Henderson to defend, but to try and start moves from that area.
But there's also something about psychology, isn't there, and a clean break and move. You know, that I think that is that for all that we can talk about technique, and you're absolutely right, Barry. You know, trapping and passing a football is fairly key. but there is something about, you know, the fact that they were that the France were able to obviously play with it slightly more unencumbered by their past than England were.
The thing is, I don't think you can teach, if a player gets to the age of 18 or 20 without having basic technique, I don't think they can learn it from then.
Of course. Yeah.
So England do need, and Ireland as well, and Scotland and Wales, but, you know, do need to set up an academy of some description to teach good young players how to play properly and not drill the skills of the game out of them in, you know, at a young age.
But that stuff is starting to happen. I mean, the Premier League academies now are light years before. So those players are starting to come through, I think. I think the question is more about what you do in the interim period, you know, next World Cup.
Video games. So, and I've got the answer there, it's video games. If you see any youngsters these days, they're all engaging in Pro Evo and FIFA flicks and twirls and pirouettes and stuff, and it's very much video games. They're going to save the nation's technique, really.
I mean, but there are still problems getting into the first team. I mean, Kieran Gibbs struggled last night trying to do that whole left flank by himself, but it's not necessarily a first team regular for Arsenal, because I mean, normally Gael Clichy would play there, wouldn't he?
I've got another bit of silver lining, actually. A bit of crowd, Shay. What
was
that?
I was just thinking in the mix zone afterwards, but one day we'll be sitting there grabbing Crouch on his way past his come on and scuff one in the 93rd minute and saying, you know, how does it feel to beat Bobby Charlton's goal scoring record?
Well, absolutely.
But as Kevin said, have any of them ever counted for anything? you know, have any of them not been in the last minute or in a important game?
He scored in a World Cup.
He has scored in a World Cup.
So that one should have been disallowed.
Fair enough, but you know, it's guile, it's ingenuity. Yeah.
You think too, they might have noticed him, wouldn't you, when he came on? He is quite obtrusive, isn't he? A big guy, but wandered in, scores the first touch. It's bizarre.
It's interesting as well that the injury sustained by Steven Gerrard seems to have caused a huge fuss.
Yes.
I don't know if you're planning on moving on to that later.
No, well, we can talk about that now or later.
Liverpool's fitness coach went on Twitter during the game to give out stink about the inept manner that England had, or a cavalier disregard England management had for Gerrard's fitness. And some journalists on Twitter seem to support his view, others saying that Capello can do what he likes with England players when they're playing for England. And you know, it's hard to know who's right.
He called the FA setup totally amateurish.
Yeah, and he then removed the tweets shortly afterwards, but
not
before someone from The Guardian had spotted them and plastered them all over the front page.
Are we meant to think that Steven Gerrard had some pre-existing problem? Because otherwise you can't go around dictating that your player only plays for an hour. They can't all be taken off after an hour, can they?
I think without knowing what was said beforehand between the FA and Liverpool, it's hard to judge the rights and the wrongs of this particular situation. But even a club v country row feels depressingly
familiar,
doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, let's shake things up a bit by going to Sid in part one, because he's going to tell us all about one of the shock results midweek, Spain's 4-0 defeat in Portugal, amongst other things. Sid, hello.
Hi, James.
Hi.
How are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks. How are you?
Not too bad. I'm returning to days of podcast yore, I think is a word. I'm in the back of a taxi.
Oh, right then. And where is this taxi speeding to and from?
It's speeding from the station in Valencia and speeding to Valencia's training ground.
All right, and who are you going to go?
It's a beautiful day, by the way, down on the Mediterranean. It was miserable in Madrid when I left this morning.
Gorgeous. Blue skies overhead, the Mediterranean glittering there as you speed towards some top-level international footballers. That, sorry, was the elephant in the room, Sid. 4-0. What on earth went on there?
Well, what went on there is... First and foremost, the bottom line is that Spain played very, very badly indeed. In fact, Vicente del Bosque after the game was quite explicit on this. He said, I don't think it's possible to play worse than we played. I think what happened as much
he
as
he hasn't seen the Wembley highlights yet, no?
Well, no, he probably hasn't. I actually had to commentate on that for Spanish TV yesterday, and it was dreadful, wasn't it? Really, really poor. But there we go. The Spain were very, very poor indeed. They I think more than anything else, that they're a victim of their success in some ways, and because that leads to two things. It leads to friendlies against sides who really like the idea of beating them, the old kind of myth of we've beaten the world champions, therefore we are kind of informally world champions for a little while. And also because the flip side of that is that they go into a lot of games now with a lack of motivation. One or two of the players were quite clear on that last night that somehow they never quite felt entirely up for it. They were never as committed or as competitive as they should have been last night against the Portuguese, whereas the Portuguese really clearly did want to win. And also there's another thing, and I don't think this should be ruled out at all as a factor, and that is that hanging over this is the Clásico. And I found it a little bit, well, distasteful maybe is the word, that in the build-up to Spain game, all the talk was about, well, will Vicente del Bosque rest the Barcelona players as much as the Madrid players, or vice versa? Is he going to play more of one than the other? Is he going to do one a favour and not the other? And he said, well, he's a Spain coach. He shouldn't give a flying one of those about what Barcelona and Madrid's situation is. He should be worried about Spain.
And what did he pick in the end? It was pretty much a first-choice Spain team, no?
Yes, it was, yeah. I mean, he pulled players off towards the end to try and give them breaks. And in particular, obviously, the question mark going into the game more than anyone else was around Xavi Hernandez, who we all know isn't fully fit, so much so that Guardiola is taking off games as early as he possibly can, as often as he possibly can. But yeah, I mean, there's no excuse in that sense that Spain were resting players. No, they played as strong a side as they could.
Mm. All right, then. I bet Marco were quite happy anyway, because Ronaldo was brill.
they were torn. They were torn. The man that they love to put on their cover, the man that they've said when he painted his toenails black, he was at the cutting edge of fashion. When he took out his earring, it was front page. He had this funny Mohican-y thing going on yesterday, and that
Travis
was on the front
Bickle
page.
Style. Huh?
Pretty bad. It was pretty bad. And that was on the front page of Marker of the day of the game. It's Cristiano Ronaldo, the threat to Spain, and he's got a new look. Ronaldo actually scored a brilliant goal last night. I don't know if you've had the chance to see it yet. Yeah. It was taken off him by Nani.
Yeah, that was hilarious. His reaction is fantastic.
Ripping off the captain's armband, throwing it down, throwing what can only be described as a bit of a fit.
One thing that
should be pointed out very quickly, James, about last night's Spain-Portugal game, and in a way I think this is almost more significant than anything else that happened. And this was played in the Stadium of Light, obviously the Lisbon one, not the Sunderland one, and it was almost entirely empty. Given that this was a game that was there to prove a point, to be a game of friendship between Portugal and Spain, and to back their bid, that was really, really disappointing that the stadium was so empty.
There's a wave of optimism again about the English bid. What's the temperature like in Spain?
Exactly the same. They're very conscious of the fact that the FIFA reports speak very highly. They know that they speak highly of England, but they're very conscious, obviously, of the fact that they speak very highly of Spain. They believe that they're now very clear favourites from this. Not so much because of, you know, an understanding of where the voting lies, although it does look like Spain have probably got 7 votes tied up for the first round at least, but because of what they think that the report shows, which is that Spain and Portugal's bid is very, very strong indeed. And that's, I think that's reinforced that some optimism that's been growing over the last few weeks, which incidentally wasn't there at the very start. So they've come a long way. The one thing that's worrying them, at this stage at least, is that they thought they were favourites for the Olympic Games when they lost out to Rio de Janeiro, having already lost out 4 years earlier, of course, to London, with Paris also in the mix. So they're saying, well, let's not get cocky because we really did think we were going to get the Olympics and we didn't get them. To be honest with you, I think they were wrong to ever think they were going to get.
We're sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.
Crikey, listeners, at that point the line went dead. FIFA suits got to Sid, I think, possibly. Owen Gibson, fill in for us here, because you're very much with your finger on the FIFA button at the moment. What's the story now? Who's going to get the World Cup?
Well, it's been an extraordinary month of, you know, of basically sort of these corruption allegations. You've had the technical bid reports come out. You've had various other allegations of collusion between rival bidders. And now we're at a point, I think, where we're entering the end game. There are only 22 voters. Some of those have got their vote tied up or promised to one bidder or another. There's about four or five left up for grabs. When I saw the England bid team yesterday, they seemed more confident than they have at any time during the last month.
But was that Prince William and Beckham and...
Yeah, that's right. And maybe that's Prince William-inspired feel-good factor, you know, right. Kind of coming through. But they seemed, 2 weeks ago, they seemed very morose. It seemed to me as though they thought they were out of the game. They now seem to be back in it. Russia were very confident, are perhaps now less so on the back of this technical report. Spain and Portugal think they've got these seven votes in the bag, but how much support they've got beyond that is open to question. So what I'm basically saying is that it's going to remain in the balance right up to those last final hours of horse trading, as these things usually do, right. And one or two votes either way could swing it, but any one of those three could still win it.
Are you saying horse trading metaphorically? Of course, let's just
indeed.
Okay. And when is the when? What date is the decision due?
December 2nd.
December 2nd. Huh? That's very exciting indeed.
A lot of the sports journalists seemed very outraged today that they were being lectured on ethics by FIFA. It's kind of difficult to know which is more hypocritical, FIFA lecturing anyone on ethics or journalists being outraged at being lectured on lack of ethics. But
it seems to me to be a strategic mistake by FIFA to turn their fire on Sunday Times. If you had any sense, surely you'd just say, thank you very much for your investigation, Sunday Times. We've suspended two of our number. We don't believe this is a widespread problem. Let's move on. But instead, they can't help themselves. You know, institutionally, they feel they need to also attack the messenger.
They're saying, yes, these guys are guilty, but they shouldn't have been exposed.
Completely, it was a completely contradictory position.
I know,
absolutely.
So, yeah. Ireland, very disappointing result there.
Not entirely unexpected. It was the Norwegians getting their revenge for the nasty comments I made about Morten Gamst-Pedersen and Alfie Inge Haaland in a recent pod.
Let that be a lesson. In Italy, well, not in Italy, but Italy, meantime, had a 1-1 draw in Austria, in Klagenfurt, curiously enough, with Romania. Say this game was played in Austria. Italy had the advantage of a home atmosphere, though, because only about 5,000 fans turned up to the stadium. Widespread disinterest in the match. And those who did behaved appallingly, you probably read the reports, the Romanian fans booed the Italy players, particularly Balotelli. And the Italian fans, or a group of them, about 50 or so far-right fans, held up banners saying, first of all, no to a multi-ethnic Italy. And another one saying, there are no black Italians. Gazzetta response, good thing there are black Italians, because Balotelli was the best thing about this very, very lacklustre Italy side. But of course, most of the comments in the Italian papers all about this ongoing problem. Obviously, Balotelli's had this a lot of times before, and we've often talked about Balotelli and his questionable character. I thought he was excellent what he said after the game. He said there's no point in stopping a game because a few fans behave like that. We do need to change these people, but you're not going to do it through a football match, and it's pointless to put up banners saying no to multi-ethnic Italy, because where I'm from, Brescia, it is already a multi-ethnic country. And I'd like to see the papers talk more about the racism problem than the number of girlfriends that I have, which is probably very fair. The other thing about Balotelli, I don't know if this has been widely reported over here, he went to the Milan derby on the weekend and afterwards had dinner with Adriano Galliani, the Milan vice president, which was seen as significant in Italy because he's a Milan fan, famously put on a Milan jersey when he was still with Inter and caused a bit of a commotion by doing so. But any kind of notion that it was just a casual meeting over dinner was rather dispelled when Balotelli yesterday came out with the following remarks. I'd love to play with Ibrahimovic. And then when they pointed out, well, Ibrahimovic is at Milan, he said, are you thinking of moves? He said, no, well, I'm at Man City, but only till June, then we'll see. So, interesting.
It's not exactly subtle.
No.
I mean, but Man City too are, in a way, dependent on, because Tevez looks exhausted before the dependence, you know, the only goal scorer, the only centre-forward in the team, etc. Mm. And Adebayor, of course, has just made no impact at all. And,
you can't see why City would want to sell him.
No, but his last game before he got sent off scored two goals. I mean, yeah. Balotelli could do a lot to transform Mancini's situation at Man City.
Hmm. He could do. We should see whether he's got the interest in doing so, because, of course, these days when players decide they don't want to be somewhere, they tend to not be there anymore. And it's curious how every time that he's not absolutely necessarily having to be in Manchester, he's back
home.
He's in Milan.
As someone who spent a lot of time in Italy, are you surprised that even now that their fans still carry on with that kind of behaviour?
Yeah, I would. I mean, the first thing is, it is a delicate thing to say their fans carry on with this kind of behaviour.
Okay, a minority of their
fans.
Well,
the thing is that football and politics in Italy has been closely linked in a way that it isn't in all other countries. I'm sure there are other countries with similar things, but football has been used for decades, since the 70s in Italy, as a vehicle for expressing political views, which is why you'll get people from a far-right organisation who'll go to a national team game to hold up banners, rather than them being ordinary Italian fans who happen to be racist. Now, I think there are issues with integration in Italy, partly, I mean, this is to put it really as briefly as possible, partly because immigration is something that happened much more recently, say, in Italy than it has in England. England's still struggling, but it's much more of an organic mix now in, say, Britain than it is in Italy, where widespread immigration only really started, I think I'm right in saying, in the 80s. So if you think back to where, say, Britain was...
Where we were in the 70s.
Two decades ago, yeah, 70s, yeah. But yes, I think there is an issue with it, but my fundamental message would be, why can't we all just get along?
Well, the Italian manager said he was enraged.
Yes.
By what was going on last night, but there was nothing he could do. Surely he could take his team off.
I think you're absolutely right. Gazzetta's saying the same thing. Why didn't the captain or why didn't Prandelli go over to the fans and tell them to stop? But I think, whilst in no way wishing to gloss over or suggest, oh, this is just a minority, etc., because with Balotelli it does happen a lot, and he's not the only player. We remember Zorro down at, Catania, I think, basically threatening to leave a game against Inter because the fans were giving him so much stick, and there was a whole hoo-ha about that. They're basically people who are there to make a political point, I think, these fans there. I mean, there will be others who are football fans. You know, we see loads of problems with Lazio fans. Famous case of Udinese hanging up an effigy of Ronnie Rosenthal with a noose around his neck, dissuading him from signing for the Friulian club. That was some decades ago, of course. But it is a problem, and not the only problem that Italian football faces, but one that, as Balotelli suggests, should be tackled a little bit more firmly. Good. Oh, the other bit of Italian news, their anti-Spanish bias kicking in there, because Rafa Benitez is, to quote the Gazzetta, hanging by a thread, which suggests the use of some particularly strong fabric. but they had a four-hour meeting at Appiano Gentile, the training ground, yesterday, because following all the disappointments in the Champions League and then the derby loss and the fact that they're a bit rubbish, the suggestion has been floated that he might be out as soon as this Monday. Woof.
And you can, who would take over?
That's the question.
Hanging around.
You can hear more in my Europaper review, available from Friday morning, listeners. Mm. Good. It is time to bring this part, whichever part it is, to a close and move on to another part, one which involves previews of a big weekend in the Premier League. Hold on. Little addendum. Scotland, yes. Kevin.
We trounced the Faroe Islands, seeing a little bit tawdry. I think a 10,000 crowd was quite good for that game, actually. People were saying it was a shame it wasn't full. I mean, I don't know what they expect. But young Bannon from Aston Villa can actually pass the ball to a teammate.
Barry Bannon.
Yes, I think this could be the way ahead for Scotland, don't you reckon?
Well, it's very much the tradition, of course.
Well, for those with a very long memory, yes.
Kevin, give us a stat about Spain's defeat in Portugal.
Yes, it's actually not the heaviest defeat, which was, of course, 6-2 to Scotland in 1963 when I was 5 years old. But I remember it vividly. He lied. But yeah, that was an era when Scotland had wonderful players who did great things but never qualified for the World Cup.
Mm. All right, then. Well, excellent stuff there from the Scots. Moving on then to the Premier League weekend. One fixture dominates proceedings. It is, of course, the North London Derby. Now, there are many numbers one can throw at this. Spurs, their infamous inability to beat the Big Four away. No wins in 67 attempts. Their appalling record in North London derbies at Arsenal. They haven't won in 17. And, of course, Arsenal beat Spurs at White Hart Lane earlier this season, 4-1 in the Carling Cup. What can we expect this weekend?
An Arsenal win.
Moving on then, Birmingham are taking on Chelsea.
But I mean, home form has been a problem, hasn't it, for Arsenal losing to Newcastle.
True.
West Brom was the other one, wasn't it? I'm going to games, I'm looking forward to it. I don't see why Arsenal shouldn't win the title. I mean, I know they have flaws, but you watch Chelsea losing 3-0 to Sunderland and the problems now for central defence coming apart, and
Frank Lampard's injury, which kind of, it's like an accelerated process. I mean, everyone knew
that. For
yeah. Who knows how long? Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's kind of accelerated process. We all knew that, of course, the dependence on Lampard and Terry was going to cause difficulties in the long term, but suddenly it's upon us. We're getting a kind of glimpse of the future in which vast amounts of money will have to be spent by Mr. Abramovich if he wants the same calibre of team.
Chelsea had gone massively clear at the top in the opening weeks, and people were saying it is an easy schedule, but at the same time they looked so dominant that it didn't seem to be
but they had everyone fit, didn't they?
And, yeah, you know, kind of. Well, now they've got a run of six games which include away to Spurs, home to Man United and away to Arsenal, which they will almost certainly be facing without John Terry and possibly Alex as well, who's having exploratory surgery. Is that right,
that's,
on his knee?
That's right, yeah. And Jogba's still not fully fit, and right. and so on.
And Essien's out for the next two games, which are Birmingham and then away at Newcastle, which isn't an easy game.
I mean, Ivanovic, from becoming a sort of fringe player at one time, he's now the key to holding that sort of the defence together during this period.
Right. Is it a bad time to face Chelsea or a good one?
I think a good one. I don't see.
I'm just thinking, you know, the reaction from that 3-0 loss at against Sunderland.
I know, I mean, but you know, but in that game, they couldn't seem to respond to the trouble they were in. They just looked tired. I mean, I think everyone said this is a very good squad, but how will they stand the pace of the campaign? And if Drogba's not interested or injured, I don't think I really believe in Anelka as a kind of player who's going to score the first goal for you. He seems to be a sort of guy who will score the second goal or the third goal.
And you can really see it in the strength of the bench, can't you? I mean, there's quite a few kids on there now. And there's, it was, you know, where it was the case sort of 2-3 years ago, that you'd have five internationals on the bench for Chelsea. Now that's not. They're trying to bring through the likes of Kakuta and Preaching, which is encouraging, but isn't going to help them this season.
We might see Bruma having to play in central defence.
Time for Frank Arnesen's work with the youth programme to really be put to the
test. You hear a lot of good things about the crop that are coming through, but again, the, as with England, I suppose the difference is: are they going to get enough time to establish themselves in a winning team? You know?
Well, we'll come back to the North London derby in a second, but just on the Chelsea front, the story now circulating vis-à-vis Ray Wilkins is that he was a victim of a clash with Frank Arnesen, and clashes with Frank Arnesen generally for some reason
Don't seem to end well.
No, not quite sure why he's so rock solid there.
He's a Mourinho. He's a Mourinho favourite. Now he's an Abramovich favourite, which obviously, as you say, was one of the factors behind Mourinho's exit. And for whatever reason, he seems to be held in high regard by Abramovich. And that's just one of about eight different conspiracy theories I've heard during the rounds about reasons why Wilkins. We've got time for the other seven. But certainly the supposed clash with Abramovich after the Inter Milan loss last season, when Wilkins supposedly stood up for the players afterwards. I've heard that one, and all the various levels of Chelsea criminology in between. I mean, you know, it's always hard to know exactly what enraged Abramovich. It's almost as though he wants to keep things, you know, interesting, isn't
unsettled.
It? Indeed, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you go. Birmingham, of course, were almost invincible at home last season, but not this time. This campaign, they've only won two out of their six home matches, and of course they're now in the bottom three despite that creditable draw with Man City. Presumably it's going to be another resolute and gritty performance from Birmingham this
season. They really missed Joe Hart, aren't they, I think, this year. I mean, I think he performed miracles for them.
It seems like Birmingham and everything, you think they're very solid teams, but what they can't afford as a forward is going to tear the opposition apart. That's always the sort of syndrome, isn't it?
Zigic hasn't really worked out for them.
No. Arsenal, incidentally.
Yes.
I suppose what makes them different from, you know, Manchester United or Chelsea is that they're going to get better, aren't they? I mean, that's the obvious aspect to the team. And
they're not going to get wound up as well, is another one.
No. Yeah. And they must have a genuine chance. I mean, we talk about Chelsea being exhausted. Well, they've got young legs that they'll be able to run from now until May, you know. So, I they're 2 points off the top. So they're playing at lunchtime on Saturday. So for a few hours at least, or whatever, they go top if they beat Spurs on Saturday.
Sami Nasri's performance again midweek was excellent. After seeing Spurs' back line in action last weekend, the thought of him and his Arsenal colleagues in midfield having a pop at that, you know, Gallison, Kabul, etc., quite an entertaining one.
If you look at look at him at this time last year compared to Nasri, it's extraordinary the way he's his renaissance has been fantastic.
And also players like Van Persie haven't really been playing till around about now. If he does, if he does get fit, stay fit and performs, that's another dimension to the team that Arsenal could really blossom this season.
No,
While the stats are damning against Spurs, I was being flippant earlier when I said, you know, Arsenal are capable of plumbing some pretty low depths, as are Spurs. So if I had to have a bet on the game, I'd go for Arsenal, but not with huge confidence, because you don't know what you're going to get until they start playing. There was a very, very revealing interview with Raphael van der Vaart in The Sun yesterday, in which he, I think, confirmed what a lot of us have suspected for some time, in that he said how much he enjoys playing at Tottenham under Harry Redknapp, because Redknapp never bores them with meetings about and long discussions about tactics or videos or, you know, arrows and chalkboards and things like that. He just sort of tells them, yeah, go out, run about. And he announces the team 20 minutes before kickoff, and then shortly before the team goes out, tells each player who to pick up at corners. That's it. I was quite surprised by that.
It's quite touching, isn't it?
If that's all he does, what's the magic in this then? What's the magical Redknapp influence?
I don't know. Because,
maybe
I mean,
it's that. Maybe he keeps it simple.
Yeah, I mean, but you just have no one. It'd be much the same when you just no one at all as manager and just let them get on with it.
Perhaps he just buys very good players and trusts them.
Yeah, I think signings are maybe the thing, aren't they?
It's fair to say that much as we may lick our lips at the thought of Nasri and Fabregas, etc., against Spurs' back line, Van der Vaart and Modric may well be making merry with the rear gunners, although that's probably not the best expression to use in this case.
I think we should speak, if by mentioning signings, I mean, Van der Vaart's a fantastic signing. That is a coup to Redknapp's favour.
Certainly is.
A tiny amount of money for, you know, for a player of that talent.
And Gallas will probably either score the winner or implode, won't he? You know?
Moving along, anyway, Man United take on Wigan. It was 5-0 to United last year. Wigan have never won at Old Trafford. Fulham are taking on City. Interesting clash, this one. First meeting of Mark Hughes and the side that ditched him, perhaps unwisely for Mancini, in the middle of last season. Ooh, Fulham are just a point off the relegation zone. But they're no pushover at home, are they?
He's still got reason to feel reasonably aggrieved, isn't he, Mark Hughes, if he looks at where they are now compared to where they were when he was ousted. And, I think Fulham at home, you'd have to say, potentially good chance of a point.
Yeah. Speaking of investing money in a team, Owen Gibson, underglared aubergine is among the many people wanting to get some decent analysis of the situation, that's my word, not his, at Sheffield Wednesday. A four-week stay of execution, or is it? Because there's another winding-up petition on the way. Is it this Monday?
There is indeed, yes. Well, and
In a nutshell,
and as succinctly as possible, I mean, the co-op have been reasonably patient, but have continued to try and accelerate this position along.
They're what, about £25 million?
Which you know, is not unusual at a football club of that size. People have been following this more closely than I actually have said. There's three or four offers on the table. We understood there to be three or four offers on the table. And then the club came out quite suddenly and said there are no serious offers, and Football League, well, we understand from the Football League that the situation is pretty stark. And, you know, you can see, I mean, they're one of those clubs that are the size of, you know, in the Premier League, when the Premier League was formed, fell out fairly quickly and have never got back there, have never cleared their debts from that time. So you'd put them in a basket with probably Charlton, Southampton, who have also faced financial difficulties in recent years. And you just, I mean, the fear is that it would need a spell in administration to clear the debt and sort it out. But
The risk is that if they do get wound up, they'll go into an administration, they'll get a point penalty, but they will effectively continue, but just with a slight handicap for a season or so.
History would tell you that would be the case, although there's always the danger in this situation that you'll be the first. You know, that you'll be the first.
Are the inland revenue not a major threat here at the moment?
HMRC,
HMRC, I mean, they seem to be
Her Majesty's Customs and Revenue. They got a wedding
revenue
to finance after all.
Are they the biggest problem, or...?
Well, the biggest problem in that they're all in these situations, they're always the most aggressive in chasing their debt, if you like. And they've got their own particular issue with football, because they don't like this football creditor rule whereby if you go into administration, then you pay all your football debts first and then you pay the tax man. That's made them particularly aggressive in chasing their debt before clubs enter administration.
All right, then.
On the subject of clubs in trouble. Just a bit of housekeeping. We were discussing the possibility of a MK Dons AFC Wimbledon second round FA Cup tie in a recent pod. That's not going to happen now because Stevenage did AFC Wimbledon fans a big, big favour by knocking MK Dons out in the first round replay on penalties.
All right then. Energy tutorial, one other thing just to finish off this part, says Matthew Burrows, the lad who scored the amazing backheel volley you mentioned a few weeks ago, is up for the FIFA Goal of the Year award. If you want to vote for it against the likes of Messi, Robin, etc., you can go to fifa.com/Ballon d'Or/Puskas Award/ video, etc., etc., etc. There you go. There you go. Now, in part three, we're going to be looking forward to more of the weekend's action, including the big game at BMO Field in Toronto. Part three, listeners, we're going transatlantic with a call to ESPN.com's Leander Scherlakens. Leander, hello.
How are you, James?
I'm ever so well, Leander. It is me. You're absolutely right. And I'm well. You're well, I hope. It's early in the morning, but yep.
I am indeed, yes. Thank
good,
you.
Good, good, good. You're probably can't sleeping at the moment because of the feverish excitement for MLS Cup final this weekend.
Yes, I'm off to Toronto in the morning, actually, for the for this year's final between the Colorado Rapids and FC Dallas.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of interest among our listeners. Texas Tipler, for example, who says, I'm interested in the Crew's take on FC Dallas's coach and 10th degree black belt, who has a unique ability to take a kick to the groin, to put it more delicately. I've seen video footage of this. Shellis Handman, is that right?
Shellis Handman, yes.
Handman, right.
He's from Macau. He's a really interesting figure. He does have a 10th degree belt in Aikijujutsu, I think it is. And he was actually described to me by a martial arts expert as if there were no such thing as weapons, he'd be one of the 10 most dangerous men in the world.
Wow. Craig Bellamy's obviously among the other nine. Who else you got?
Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris.
Phil
got.
Neville.
Phil Neville.
It'd be great in your business card, one of the most 10 most dangerous people in the world.
Right. That's fantastic, isn't it? He didn't name any of the others, though, did he?
No, unfortunately.
Fantastic. Anyway, let's get on to the meat of this. It's not the final that you might have expected, is it?
Well, no. I mean, especially from a league point of view, you would sort of hope for the most star-studded teams, obviously being the Los Angeles Galaxy with David Beckham and Landon Donovan, and the New York Red Bulls with Thierry Henry and Rafa Marquez to make it to the final. Also, from the point of view of this being a league that's not been around for terribly long, you want those big markets to make it very far, because now instead of having one market of 19 million people against a market of 15 million people, you've got a 6.5 million people a market in Denver. In Dallas, playing a 2.5 million people market in Denver. And so that's going to make a big difference in the ratings, which ultimately is what it tends to come down to.
All right, okay. Will it outrank the Scrabble Championships this year, or is that too much to hope for?
I've not seen this year's Scrabble Championship ratings. But
that's a big lineup.
I do know that the overall ratings are slightly down from last year, which was disappointing to people in the league.
Right, okay. Which team should we be rooting for?
They're very fairly matched teams, but I think coming from England as you do, you'd probably have to root for Colorado because their duo of manager and system manager are English. They are Gary Smith, a former Wickham Wanderers hard man in the midfield, and Steve Guppy, who've built a very strong reputation here and have built a really good team.
Excellent. FC Dallas, formerly known as Dallas Burn. I note their team anthem is performed by the exciting Polyphonic Spree.
Yeah. I saw them in concert once. I'm hoping they're not going to be around in Toronto, to be honest with you.
You didn't enjoy the concert, Leander?
No, I'm not much into the Spree.
Right. I saw them in concert as well. I left after 15 minutes.
Right.
It was truly shocking.
You couldn't find the exit.
Pony, I think it's fair to say.
No, I hasten to add, I went because a friend wanted to go and he had a spare ticket. Because no one else would go, I soon realised why.
Right. They had that one about my soldier girl, yeah?
No, it's follow the day, follow the day.
Right.
Follow the day. It's very
now available as a ringtone.
Yeah, and they wear sort of choir outfits, yep. And there's about 50 of them.
My Soldier Girl. That's the one I know.
Yeah,
Owen Gibson's giving me some backup there. Sorry, back to the MLS Cup final.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm glad I got up early to hear Barry sing.
Sorry.
Players we should watch out for, Leander?
The strikers on the Colorado Rapids, Omar Cummings is the head striker for Jamaica. He's very good. Next to him is Connor Casey, a sometime U.S. striker. FC Dallas is actually a really exciting young team with a lot of guys who you'll probably see at a World Cup for the U.S. in future years, with Breck Shea and Dax McCarty and a playmaker from Colombia called David Ferreira, who's most likely going to be the league MVP.
All right.
He was one of those old-fashioned South American slow-down-the-game playmakers, which is quite a rare sight these days.
Right. Leander, you were saying that the figures are slightly down, and am I right in thinking that the whole kind of MLS Beckham-fueled breaking through to the big-time experiment still hasn't quite turned the proverbial corner?
Well, I mean, having covered the American game for a year now, this is something that sort of baffles me, where people keep expecting this one watershed moment to really put soccer on the map here in America. I just don't think it's going to work that way. It's not going to take one World Cup or this one player arriving. It's something that you have to slowly pick away at, because there's so much competition from other sports. So perhaps to expect Beckham to come in here and suddenly make this sport relevant among all American sports fans was simply not realistic. But he has 1 year left on his contract, and his contract actually had a provision that if he completed all 5 years of it, it would give him the right to buy an MLS team to sort of one of next round of franchises is added for him to take over one. So it does seem that he's in it for the long term, so perhaps we should sort of judge him over more than these 5 years just as a player.
It's Owen here. Speaking of World Cups, we've been talking a lot about the English World Cup bid. Is there much excitement over there about the US World Cup bid? Is that seen as something that could help this process of taking soccer football to the next level?
Well, frankly, I expect support among politicians to have dwindled with the Republicans winning the elections a few weeks ago and taking back control of Congress. I mean, soccer here is something that's still something embraced primarily by liberals and railed against by a lot of conservative pundits. So their having taken control is actually not going to be good news for the American bid, and I believe that some of the news that leaked on the reports is that there is concern from FIFA's part a little bit about the political support here. Of course, the soccer community is hugely excited, and I think the U.S. is a country that'd be very well prepared, because all of these NFL stadiums, I think there are a few that need to be widened a little bit to accommodate everything that goes around a World Cup field. But other than that, it's a country that, like England, is very World Cup ready. But of course, you'll have to see if FIFA ultimately decides that they want to put it into a country that's new.
All right. It would be fantastic to see Brazil taking on Argentina at Dick's Sporting Goods Park. But we'll have to wait and see. Fingers crossed. Leander, thanks ever so much for that, and have a super day.
Thank you, James. You too.
Right. Now, of relatively minor interest, but still worth mentioning all the same, there are some more Premier League matches this weekend. Let's see. Blackpool are taking on Wolverhampton. Neither side have won in the last three matches, but both playing some good football. No? Yep. West Brom taking on Stoke. West Brom had a poor run of results. So Stoke, meanwhile, though, seem to have got their mojo back.
Well, I mean, they did their classic job on Liverpool, didn't they, the other day? I mean, it's a bit very effective at home.
Well, you mentioned Liverpool. They will attempt to bounce back from their Potter's disaster against West Ham. Now, grave though the result was last weekend, and indeed the draw with Wigan before that, if results go their way, they could be up in fifth by the end of the weekend.
It's just sort of jammed, doesn't it? I mean, it's sort of a couple of teams at the bottom, the ones at the top. Apart from that, they're all within a few points of each other. I mean, it's not a coincidence, is it? I mean, there's probably not a single team this season that you would say was fantastic. We did praise Chelsea, but there was that question, will they sustain it? And the answer seems to be no at the moment, doesn't it? Mm. So it's great in a way. It's the Premier League has dropped from its zenith, but I think it's a more interesting competition, if not as classy a competition.
Torres in doubt. He certainly didn't play for Spain midweek. Steven Gerrard, you were mentioning this, Barry, before, has done what? His hamstring, is it?
Yeah. He could be out for 3 weeks or a month.
Right. unlikely to feature in this game. Also, Born Blue posting in to point out that Lucas Leiva will miss the game against West Ham after his red card at Stoke. West Ham, though, have said they will appeal against the sending off. Budum. Tish. Prawn saying, Born Blue, that might be funny, except for the fact that his replacement will be Christian Poulsen. West Ham do have a terrible record at Anfield. They haven't won away this season. They've only had one victory, indeed, all campaign. So even though massively under strength, Liverpool should presumably still be favourites in this game, no?
They'll be favourites. Whether or not they win is another matter.
No, it's like happy times at Upton Park either at the moment. So, you know, less than fulsome backing from Karen Brady for Grant this week.
Oh, what did she say?
Well, it was a classic vote of confidence, you know, kind of slightly backhanded. He's our manager.
It says here.
Yeah. All right, then. In other news, Blackburn will be hosting Aston Villa on Sunday. Aston Villa with added Robert Pires. That's an interesting move, isn't it?
Really investing in youth, aren't they?
Yeah. All right, Sunderland take on Everton in the Monday night game. They looked unstoppable against Chelsea, but can they follow that up with a win against the Toffees, Barry?
I don't know. I don't have a huge amount of faith, and my worry is that Sunderland's players will think, right, we're great, and take their foot off the gas. I really hope that doesn't happen, because there's the makings of an excellent team there at the Stadium of Light.
And, all right. Do you think poor old Jordan Henderson, will he be in any way suffering the after effects of...
I'm sure he'll be all right.
Oh, OK, super. And then finally, Bolton. Now, this is a big game. Bolton are at home to Newcastle. Barry, you've got big news on the Kevin Davis front.
Yeah, well, we discussed on Monday about Kevin Davis on Twitter, and it emerged that we believed he was henpecked by Mrs. Davis. And Mrs. Davis got wind of what we'd been talking about, listened to the podcast, and found it all highly amusing. But she insists she doesn't henpeck her husband, and then she conceded that, maybe she does a bit.
Right.
And I asked her in the course of our...
Tweet conversation,
if... he elbows her in his sleep.
Right.
And she said no, because he sleeps in a spare room night before games. And so she also said that she couldn't keep him under the thumb because her thumb isn't big enough to keep it over his huge, and I quote, anvil-shaped head.
Right. So, how confident are you that this is indeed Mrs.
Oh, I'm absolutely certain it's Mrs. Davis.
What makes you certain?
I did research, and it is Mrs. Davis. And then yesterday I was...
Speaking of journalist Barry, I did research, and it is.
No, it is definitely Mrs. Davis. And then last night, or yesterday afternoon, Kevin Davis was trying to toast a Pop-Tart.
Yes.
He was very bored at home.
Yes.
And trying to toast a Pop-Tart. And he got so confused about how to use his toaster that he took a picture of it.
Well, there were two dials on the toaster, crucially.
It's quite ironic that he was not... technically savvy enough to actually toast a Pop-Tart, but was technically savvy enough to upload a photograph of his toaster onto Twitter so that we could help him.
Isn't it sad seeing another Premier League player seeing his domestic bliss spoiled by the misuse of tarts? Did he resolve the issue for him?
It was resolved, yes. It was pretty straightforward toaster, but strangely, a three-slice toaster, which I've never seen before. Toasters generally come...
It's a Premier League player, Barry. He's probably had it custom built.
No, well, again, his wife rode to the rescue again and pointed out that she had brought it home in Canada, so it was purchased in Canada where she used to live. That would explain its weirdness.
Right, okay. And you were the last person he said goodnight to, Kevin Davis.
Yes. Well, I presume he looked in on his kids. But yeah, there's quite the bromance blossoming between myself and Kev. We might go, I don't know, hang gliding or something next week.
I think it's extremely likely. I'm very, very happy for the pair of you.
Are you slightly jealous, James?
Not at all. Not at all. I have my own Premier League bromance.
With who?
Wazza and Colleen. Yeah, ever since we had a satirical podcast about them, she texted in and, you know. Anyway... that's it for today. Do join us again on Monday when we'll be, you know, etc. and so on. But in the meantime, many thanks to Owen Gibson, to Kevin McCarron, Barry Glendenning, to producer Ben, and you, the listener, and have a lovely weekend. Just a quick reminder, pay-per-view, Friday morning, Guardian website.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible. The Guardian.